and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, Barry Eichengreen, Professor of Economics and Political Science at UC Berkeley. Hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council, his talk, based on his book, Exorbitant Privilege, The Rise and Fall of the Dollar and the Future of the International Monetary System, was recorded in Anchorage on April 19th.
Hello and welcome, everyone. Hello, I'd like to welcome everyone today to the Alaska World Affairs Council. It's great to see so many faces. My name is Lisa Falsko. I'm CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council, and you are in for a real treat today with our speaker. Now I'd like to introduce our head table. To my far left is Mr. Garrett Wong. You might recognize him from Channel 2 Market View. In addition to that, he is the chairman of our board and makes my job a pleasure every day. It's such a privilege to have him as the chairman of our board. Mr. Garrett Wong. And to his left, we have Mr. John Bittner, Vice President of AEDC, Anchorage Economic Development Corporation, who will come to the podium to introduce our speaker. John.
Thank you, Lisa. Good afternoon. As you heard, I'm John Bittner, the Vice President of the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation. And I just want to take a moment to tell you that AEDC in general and myself personally are a huge supporter of the wonderful work the Alaska World Affairs Council does. Events like this are a real benefit to the community and to the economy here, and I just can't thank them enough for doing this week after week. By joining the Alaska World Affairs Council, you can help bring these types of speakers to Alaska. I strongly urge you to support them as AEDC supports them as well. It's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Professor Barry Eichengreen. Barry is a professor of economics and a professor of political science at the University of California, Berkeley. He's taught there since 1987. He's a research associate of the National Bureau of Economic Research in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and a research fellow of the Center for Economic Policy Research in London, England. In 1997-98, he was a senior policy advisor at the International Monetary Fund, and he is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Professor Eichengreen is the convener of the Bellagio Group of Academics and Economic Officials and chair of the Academic Advisory Committee of the Peterson Institute of International Economics. He has held Guggenheim and Fulbright Fellowships and has been a fellow of the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Palo Alto and the Institute for Advanced Study in Berlin. He's a regular monthly columnist for Project Syndicate, and he was awarded the Economics History Association's Jonathan R.T. Hughes Prize for Excellence in Teaching in 2002, and the University of California at Berkeley Social Science Division's Distinguished Teaching Award in 2004. He's the recipient of a Doctor Honoris Causa from the American University in Paris, and the 2010 recipient of the Schumpeter Prize from the International Schumpeter Society. He was named one of the Foreign Policy Magazine's 100 Leading Global Thinkers in 2011, and is the past president of the Economic History Association. Professor Barry Eichengreen is here today to speak to us about Exorbitant Privilege, the Rise and Fall of the Dollar, and the Future of the International Monetary System. Please join me in welcoming Professor Eichengreen to the podium. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. Let me thank also Lisa and Carrie and Garrett from the World Affairs Council. It is a treat for me to be here today and have a chance to learn a little bit about Alaska and to get your reactions to my ideas as well. So my plan here is, you will have heard this from a professor before, not to go on for too long and try to leave time for your comments and questions. The point of departure for my talk this afternoon is a simple observation. The observation being that the dollar is not only our currency, but in addition, the world's. If you've traveled abroad, you will know very well that US dollars, greenbacks, are widely used for a variety of transactions, not only in the United States, but in a large number of other countries. A fact that gives the United States, quote, the exorbitant privilege, unquote, of issuing the only true global currency. So we have the ability to import shiny cars from foreign countries and export green pieces of paper, which can be produced at low cost in return. That term, exorbitant privilege, comes from the French. It sounds rather more elegant. In the original, it was popularized by French President Charles de Gaulle in the 1960s, who didn't like this fact one bit. He thought there was something unfair and unjust about the fact that the United States could acquire resources, import merchandise from other countries, purchase French companies, and pay with these little green pieces of paper. I wrote a book, obviously, about this subject, and the argument of the book was that the dollar's exorbitant privilege as the only true global currency, something that has been the state of affairs for more than half a century now, is coming to an end. I argued that we are beginning to move now to a world of multiple global currencies. Three in particular, the currencies of the three big economies, the United States, Europe, and China. I concluded that on balance, this was a good thing, that moving to this world of that doesn't depend so heavily on the dollar to finance and facilitate international transactions was a good thing on balance, that it would make the world a safer financial place. It takes a long time to write a book. It takes longer, it seems, for the publisher actually to bring it out. So it's now 3 years since my manuscript went off to the publisher, and a lot has happened in our world, in our monetary and financial world in particular, in the next 3 years. So what I want to do for the next few minutes is to revisit my arguments, to mark them to market, to see whether they still hold water after all this time. What did I get right? What did I get wrong? And which of my conclusions do I have to rethink? I acknowledged in the book that our global monetary and financial system still rests to a remarkable extent on the dollar. So if you look at the foreign exchange market, for example, where different currencies are traded for one another, hundreds of currencies are traded for one another, U.S. dollars are involved in fully 85% of those foreign exchange transactions. 85% of all trades of currencies worldwide are trades of the dollar for some other currency. Central banks hold foreign bank deposits and foreign bonds as reserves, as a war chest or a cushion in the event that something goes wrong financially. Fully 62% of their foreign reserves are in the form of dollars. The dollar is used to invoice and finance and settle import and export trade, international trade in manufactures and commodities, to a much greater extent than the United States itself is involved in importing and exporting. So our 21st century globalization rests to a striking extent on the dollar. Think about it this way. The United States is only 20% of the global economy as we sit here today, but the dollar is involved in 85% of all foreign exchange transactions. That's an unusual state of affairs, pointing to the question, why does it exist now, and how long might it continue? My argument, as I said before, is that this peculiar state of affairs where the dollar is the only consequential, only true global currency, will not continue indefinitely for five reasons. The first one being that the old argument that there's only room in the world for one true international currency no longer holds water. So once upon a time, people argued, for a long time now, people have argued, that everybody has an interest in using dollars when they purchase goods from another country or they invest in another country, because everybody else is using dollars for those kind of transactions. It pays to use the same unit, the same national currency that everybody else is using. So if you're a company and you want to break into international markets and you have to tell people how much your goods cost, you're going to denominate those prices, express those prices in dollars, because that's what everybody else does, enabling your customer to compare prices and decide whether you have a competitive product or not. There was room for only one standard, one measuring rod in the international economy, and for the longest time that measuring rod was the dollar. Everybody used dollars because everybody else used dollars, and there was no incentive to move away. That's a familiar argument, and we've heard it in a variety of other applications. For example, operating systems for laptop computers and personal electronics. Everybody had to use Windows because everybody else used Windows. And if you're anything other than a dedicated computer hobbyist, and at work you really had to exchange files and data and so forth with your coworkers, if they used Windows, you had to use Windows too. Windows was the market leader because everybody was using it, it got locked in, and nobody had an incentive to do anything else. That was true once upon a time, right? But it's no longer true today. We've learned how to build open systems where some people can use Windows and other people can use Apple's operating system and other people can use Linux. And we've learned how to exchange information across those platforms. I think the same is now true in the monetary and financial sphere in my world. Once upon a time, it was difficult to compare the prices of different goods denominated in different currencies. You had to buy a newspaper to figure out how much that foreign currency was worth, or call your broker, or whatever. But now everybody carries in their pocket a device called a smartphone, which you except during talks like this when you've turned it off, that you can, you know, compare those prices in real time. And if somebody else wants to tell you how much their automobiles cost in Korean won, you can figure out what that means in US dollars easily enough. So I think this argument, there's only room for one international currency, it's the dollar at the moment, so it's going to remain the dollar, no longer holds water. Secondly, I think the argument that the dollar, secondly, there is the argument that the dollar will no longer dominate in the future for the simple reason that the US is no longer as economically dominant as it once was. Coming out of World War II, the rest of the world was an economic mess. The United States accounted for half of the industrial production of the free world, but there was reconstruction and recovery, and other parts of the world have begun closing the economic gap vis-a-vis the US. After World War II, it made perfect sense to do your transactions in dollars because so many of those transactions were with the US. That's no longer true now that we account for not half the global economy, but only 20 or 25%. Third, we are no longer the only country in the world with deep and liquid financial markets open to foreign investors. After World War II, this was the case. If foreigners wanted a source of safe and liquid assets, the only place they could go to get them was the United States, because other countries had regulations and controls on foreign investment, underdeveloped financial markets, other problems. That's no longer the case when a bunch of different countries today have deep and liquid financial markets open to the rest of the world. A fourth reason why the dollar's international monopoly won't continue is that the capacity of the US government, the US Treasury, to provide safe and liquid assets to the rest of the world is limited. What the rest of the world likes when they hold dollars is that dollars are liquid, they can be bought and sold easily, they're safe. They're backed by the full faith and credit, such as it is, of the U.S. Treasury Department. But as the U.S. economy and our fiscal system grow more slowly than the world as a whole, this is another instance in which it matters that other countries starting out behind are catching up to the United States. Our capacity to provide those safe and liquid assets on the scale that 21st century globalization requires will be cast into doubt. Fifth and finally, the dollar's monopoly won't continue, I argue, because the U.S. faces significant economic and political challenges that raise questions in the minds of international investors who will be reluctant to put all their eggs in one basket. So let me say now a few more words about those economic and political challenges as I see them. The most important one, of course, being that economic growth following the financial crisis continues to disappoint. So I show you here a figure with recovery from all of the important post-war recessions, starting at the left from the trough, the bottom of the business cycle downturn. The blue lines are previous recoveries, and the red line is the current one. So you can see that the current recovery is disappointing by historical standards. Things are now getting better in the United States economically. The economy is beginning to heal, to all appearances. We are putting the financial crisis behind us, but nonetheless, recovery from the recent downturn continues to be disappointing. You can see that here as well if you look at the employment picture, that the collapse of employment in the crisis was dramatic. The red line in this figure compared to previous recessions, you can see the other employment declines and recoveries. Employment is now beginning to recover, but only at a lethargic pace by historical standards. In March, we added, according to the establishment survey, the survey the Labor Department does of businesses, only 88,000 jobs. We need to add 250,000 jobs a month in order to begin to bring the unemployment rate down, because that's about how big the labor force, how much the labor force grows by, 250,000 people a month. The numbers in January were a little better, only a little bit better. So you see in the employment and unemployment figures more evidence that we may be doing a little better than we were economically in 2008, 2009, but only a little bit. Consumer spending is improving. Real consumption, consumer spending has been rising, but only at a 1.3% annual rate, according to the most recent figures. So it's going to be hard to grow the economy by 3 or 4% a year, which is what we normally do in an expansion or in an economic recovery or in the expansion phase of the business cycle. If the main driver of the economy, which is the consumer, of course, consumption is 2/3 of the economy, if the consumer is not spending. And the consumer is not spending as she normally does during a recovery because of weak consumer confidence. Consumers are worried about high gas prices. They're affected by the increase in payroll taxes that kicked in on January 1st. They hear about the sequester and worry about what that implies for the economy. They hear all this political noise coming out of Washington, D.C. There are plenty of reasons to worry about consumer confidence. Two things are better. One thing that is clearly better now is the housing market. So it's been interesting for me yesterday and today to talk to people here in Anchorage about the housing market. I guess your housing market in Alaska is rather different from ours in the lower 48. It's driven by different factors like what's happening to the energy market and so forth. Where I live, we saw a dramatic collapse in housing prices, and now we're seeing a dramatic bounce back. Home prices, according to the best numbers we have, were up more than 10% between February of 2012 and February of 2013, that being the most recent data we have. So the housing market is really bouncing back. We see it in low inventory of unsold homes. We see it in construction activity beginning to come back. That's the good news, and the bad news is that the housing sector, housing construction, is simply too small now to drive the economy. You can see it in this figure that in the good old days, I should put that in quotes, before 2007, there were a lot of housing starts. New home construction fell to very low levels. Now it's picking up again, but from low levels means that there's too little of it to drive the recovery. Once upon a time, residential construction was more than 6% of the U.S. economy. So when it went up or went down, that was a big deal. Now it's less than 3% of the U.S. economy, reflecting the low levels to which it fell. That's not enough to guarantee the kind of housing led recovery that post-World War II experience had led us to become accustomed to. The other thing, and here I will surely, I intend, in fact, to provoke you, the other good news, the other problem that has been solved is, of course, the budget problem. We no longer have a federal debt or deficit problem in the United States. We have eliminated, and we know that because the data show that we have. We have figures on federal revenues and outlays through March of 2013, released last week. They show that the budget deficit as a share of our economy has fallen by more than half now. And we're on a trajectory to reduce the budget deficit to the low single digits as a share of GDP. If we succeed in growing our economy reasonably well at 2 or 3% per annum and nothing else changes, the debt as a share of national income, that's what matters, right? Not the absolute amount of debt, but how heavy it is compared to our productive capacity, our tax payments, the size of our economy. That ratio of debt to GDP will now stabilize at around 75%. That's higher than one would like. It's a little high for comfort, but the debt is not going to grow explosively given current policies in place. So through the operation of a variety of factors, the end of the stimulus, the increase in payroll taxes, the sequester, it looks like, and if nothing else changes, the deficit problem is now behind us as well. Although that only reinforces my point before, that if we are not going to be pumping out Treasury bonds, U.S. Treasury bonds hand over fist as a result of running big deficits, our ability to provide that Treasury debt that foreigners so anxiously want to hold will be limited. Enough about us, let me talk a little bit about them, because that's one way for us to feel better about our predicament. If you really want to feel better, compare the U.S. economy, which is growing by 2% this year and will probably grow by 3% next year, with Europe, with the Eurozone, where they're not growing at all this year, and next year looks equally dismal. In my book, I made the argument that looking 10 years out, there were likely to be three consequential global currencies that commanded the confidence of investors: the dollar, the euro, and the Chinese renminbi. So here's where I have a little bit of writer's remorse. I didn't my book went off to the publisher when the Greek crisis began erupting, so it wasn't entirely a surprise, but the incompetence of European policymakers and their inability to draw a line under their crisis has been a surprise. And the euro, which had gained something of an international role. For example, it accounted for more than a quarter of the foreign currency reserves held by central banks and governments around the world. The euro has been losing the confidence of investors, and it has been giving back ground that it had gained previously as an international currency. The European Central Bank publishes a report on this question each year called the International Role of the Euro. Those reports used to be high profile and triumphant. Now they're released without the same fanfare. The most recent one showed that the share of the euro in global currency reserves peaked in 2009 at 28%. It's now down to 24% and heading down further. What has made Europe's crisis so intractable? Part of the problem, of course, is the one Henry Kissinger pointed to when he said, when there's a crisis, who in Europe do you call? That there isn't a unified political system. Rather, there are 17 national governments bound together in the euro area. So the difficulty of reaching political agreement and implementing political agreements is one reason the crisis is so intractable. The other reason is that Europe really has not one crisis, but three. It has a debt crisis. In southern Europe, debt loads are much heavier than in the United States. Given economies that are not growing, those debts are not sustainable. The money that has been borrowed simply cannot be repaid. But what to do about that is economically difficult and politically very difficult. Number two, Europe has a banking crisis. So we Americans are not all entirely happy about the way we fixed our banking system in 2009. There are lots of, in my view, justified complaints about banks getting off easily and taxpayers not getting off the hook. But we at least fixed our banking system, and the Europeans have not begun to do the same. So in the Eurozone, they have approximately 17 broken national banking systems that have not been recapitalized, have not been restructured. Banks are not lending, and if banks don't lend, economies don't grow, leading to their third problem, which is a growth crisis, which has very grave social, economic, and political consequences. So if you look at the case of Greece, Greece is suffering contraction every bit as severe as the United States suffered in 1929, 1933. That was the Great Depression, the great economic catastrophe in American economic history, when the size of the US economy shrank by a quarter, when the unemployment rate went up in the United States to 25%. I remind you, in the recent crisis, it went up to 10%, which was plenty bad. But the Great Depression was a whole nother order of magnitude. Greece is now suffering through a Great Depression. The economy has shrunk by a fifth. Next year, it will have shrunk by 25%, just like the United States did, U.S. economy did in the 1930s. The same will be true in Cyprus, and unless something changes, the same will be true in Portugal and Spain. And elsewhere. So why are these economies shrinking to the extent they are? Well, to start with, governments are cutting spending, not with a scalpel, but with a hatchet. They're cutting spending very dramatically and raising taxes, even though their economies are contracting, in order to desperately try to balance budgets and prevent these unsustainable debt loads from rising further. And here I have some measures of what's called fiscal thrust, how much extra spending is the government injecting into the economy or withdrawing, fiscal thrust is strongly negative across Europe, but especially across Southern Europe. Monetary policy is too tight for the Southern Europeans. So they have one central bank that makes monetary policy for the Eurozone as a whole. In Germany, wages are going up by 3% a year, which is uncomfortably high inflation for the good citizens of Germany. That's why the European Central Bank continues to follow a relatively austere monetary policy. But that tight monetary policy, compared to monetary policy in the US, removes another potential source of demand and growth for the Eurozone economy. And finally, Europe has the problem that they're not rebalancing. So everyone will agree that Southern Europeans had been living beyond their means for a decade. Now they're adjusting, they're spending less. But if Southern Europeans are spending less, somebody else has to spend more in order to absorb the goods and services being produced by the European economy. If Southern Europeans are spending less, it follows logically that, fill in the blank, Northern Europeans should be spending more, and they're not, that Germany and its neighbors are not contributing to the solution of this rebalancing problem. So you have recession across Europe, massive recession across Southern Europe, which creates a lot of political unhappiness, as you well know, or you can well imagine. It creates protests, including violent ones, in the street. It gives rise to radical anti-system parties, political parties, on the left and on the right as well. And it discredits the old elites and previously dominant parties. And it leaves countries like Italy without a government, without a leader who can bring the country together to decide about what to do about this mess. So Beppe Grillo, of course, is the comedian who started a new political party, the Five Star Movement, in Italy a couple of years ago with no platform, no coherent platform, but his stump speeches were very funny and very entertaining, and he won 25% of the vote in the recent Italian election, part as a protest because people were unhappy about the status quo. European leaders tell us that recovery is right around the corner and that the European economies will bottom out and start to grow again maybe in the second half of this year. I don't see it because the things that normally lead stabilization and recovery, firms begin to accumulate inventories because they know there's going to be more spending in the future. They begin to invest. Those responses are not happening. So what does Europe need to do if it has three problems it needs, three solutions? If it has a debt crisis, it needs to get rid of the excessive debt. So that can happen magically if they are able to grow their economies, grow the denominator of the debt to national income ratio, which is wishful thinking in the present instance, or they can acknowledge that the debt can't be repaid and write it down, give investors in their government bonds what people in the markets call a haircut, and tell them you can have 59 cents on the euro rather than 100, as we promised you before. Greece has done it, and other European countries are going to do the same. They need to solve their banking crisis by acknowledging that they have one, by injecting more public funds into the banks, by creating the equivalent. We have the Federal Deposit Insurance Commission, the FDIC, in the United States to insure bank deposits up to $250,000 in all 50 states. They don't have a European FDIC to create confidence in the banks. They need to create one. And finally, they need to begin to grow their economies again. They need to solve their growth crisis by a combination of supply-side reforms, which is all they talk about, and also some support for demand for spending from the European Central Bank and the German government, something that they do not talk about. So will they do these things? Will Europe draw a line under its crisis? Actually, I've worked on the euro for a long time, since before it existed, and many people accuse me of having gone native, of having become of drinking the European Kool-Aid and believing what they say. But I think there are two reasons to think positive, that Europe will draw a line under its crisis and do what it takes to solve these problems and creating a positive future for the euro. The first one is they have a tremendous amount invested politically in the project. The euro is there's a larger European project of integration that goes back to the European Community and the European Union and the single unified market for goods and services, where they have a proto executive branch, the European Commission, and a European Court of Justice, and a European Parliament. Deeper integration has been the goal of European policy now for 50 years. And to regard that as a failed project would be deeply humiliating. This French technocrat I show you here, Jean Monnet, was the father of European integration in the 1950s. And in one of his speeches, he said, the Europe we see today is the result of our collective responses to the crises we have faced in the future. Europe only moves forward through crises. It's at a point now where it either has to go back to national economies or go forward to deeper integration. The amount they have wrapped up in the political project suggests that they will find a way to go forward. The second reason I think they will hold it together, more likely than not, is the simple economic calculus of what breaking the euro up would mean. Holding the euro together is expensive and difficult and painful, but breaking it up would be even more expensive and difficult and painful. It would provoke the mother of all financial crises. It would be Lehman Brothers times two. So imagine that you're a Greek leader, and you have the idea that maybe Greece would be in better shape if it abandoned the euro, left the eurozone, reintroduced its national currency, the drachma. Greece is also the oldest democracy in the world. So there would have to be discussion of this, parliamentary debate, the passage of a law, and all that. You're a Greek household. What would you do on the first minute you got wind of the possibility that this was even being discussed, much less decided? You'd wire all your money to Frankfurt, right, where it would be in safe, good old euros, guaranteed to hold their value, as opposed to drachmas. This would make any bank run that we've seen in the past, any bond market collapse we've seen in the past, look like child's play. So I was asked to write for the book I show you here, Europe and the Euro, a paper about breakup scenarios 6 years ago. And I concluded could not happen, would not happen, because breaking it up would be even more expensive and disruptive than holding it together, and politicians making that calculation would go forward and do just enough to hold it together. So my economic argument was sound. My political argument there was wrong. Obviously, politicians don't always compare the costs and benefits of alternative courses of action and take the more sensible alternative. So things can still go wrong. Irresponsible politicians in the heat of debate can still take a decision that has very high costs. So I wouldn't rule out breakup entirely. I'm somewhat out of consensus on my forecast about what's going to happen to the euro. You stop an economist on the street, especially in this country, and he or she will say, the euro will not survive. It's going to break up. They don't have a political union. They don't have a fiscal union. They don't have a banking union like we have in the U.S. They can't make it. I think there's a possibility that those Americans underestimate the commitment, the will of Europeans to create those other institutions. So my forecast, nothing is certain in the world of economics, but I would say the probability of the euro breaking up in the next 5 years is no more than 15%. The probability of a miraculous resumption of growth and all these other problems receding as a result is similarly no more than 15%. So the most likely scenario is a lost decade, where the next 5 years look a lot like the last 5 years in Europe, where there's continuing financial turbulence, uncertainty, and no growth. Something that wouldn't bode well for the euro significantly expanding its role as an international currency. Let me try to end on a happier note, the happier note having to do with the third player here, China. So in addition to the US and the Eurozone, China is the other economy with a large enough platform. It's big enough to stand behind, to issue a true global currency. And that indeed is what Chinese leaders have in mind. They are committed to internationalizing their currency, the renminbi, to try to encourage its use for as a vehicle for invoicing and settling import and export transactions and foreign investment, not only with and by China, but in the rest of the world as well. Chinese leaders understand that it's a convenience, an advantage for U.S. banks and firms to be able to do cross-border business in their own currency using dollars. And they want the same advantage for Chinese banks and firms, that they should be able to do cross-border business in their own currency, the renminbi. And they imagine that there will be a lot of appetite for doing that in their neighborhood in particular, that the renminbi will become the dominant currency in Asia sooner rather than later. But China has challenges that it will have to successfully surmount in order to encourage significant international use of its currency. There's the fact that its financial markets are small and not very liquid. There's not much trading in Chinese bonds and the like, certainly not by US standards. Those markets are not yet open to the rest of the world. China has controls on inward and outward financial flows. And you have to do a lot of work at strengthening your domestic markets before it's safe to lift those controls. Finally, I think China is now heading into a more difficult period. China has been growing for three decades at 10% per annum. That will not continue. The Chinese economy now is going to slow down, and that will strain the management capacity of Chinese policymakers. They may find they have higher priorities than working on financial development and currency internationalization. Why am I so confident the Chinese economy is going to slow down? Because the labor force has already stopped growing in China. They've had a one-child policy for decades. Because Chinese wages, labor costs, are now beginning to rise. They rose last year in the manufacturing sector, depending on firm, by up to 20%. Because they've been growing so fast on the basis of extraordinarily high investment. And no country can productively invest 50% of its national income year after year after year. After you've built one bullet train line between Beijing and Shanghai, you can't build another one productively alongside. And because history tells us that no economy grows by 10% per annum forever. Finally, there is the question. I'm always very careful about how I pose this one when I am in China. Is China's political system compatible with its monetary ambitions? all international and reserve currencies in history have been the currencies of republics or political democracies. The dollar, we don't have a large sample, but humor me, the dollar, the British pound before it, the Dutch guilder before that, the currencies of the city-states of Venice and Genoa, they have all had political systems that placed limits on the arbitrary power of the president or the king or what we might call in the Chinese context, the executive. Why might democracy matter for international currency status? Because democracies have checks on arbitrary action by the executive. And they give investors, creditors, voice in the decisions that are being made. Democracies, history tells us, are better at developing deep and liquid financial markets because creditors, investors have a voice in those decisions. Democracies are better able to attract foreign investors in particular. So China has to do something. I'm not saying China needs Arab Spring before it can successfully internationalize the renminbi, but it does have to establish limits on the arbitrary decisions of the Politburo, and it does have to give investors more voice in those decisions. So China has moved in that direction. The National People's Congress, the congressional branch, if I can use that word, of Chinese government, has been given more authority. Chinese officials are being required to be more transparent about their decisions. Internet-based movements, non-governmental organizations have made a difference in terms of environmental policy in China, in terms of labor rights in China. Maybe they'll make a difference in terms of monetary and financial policies as well. That's the hope in any case. What if that doesn't happen? What if Europe doesn't draw a line under its crisis and China fails to successfully internationalize the renminbi? Then there still will be only one consequential source of liquidity, of grease for the wheels of 21st century globalization. That will be the dollar. But as the United States comes to account for a progressively smaller and smaller share of the global economy, which is what's going to happen if Brazil and India and other parts of the world develop successfully, our capacity to provide safe and liquid dollars on the scale the world requires will be strained, in which case the world economy will be starved of liquidity. What happens then? It becomes harder to get dollar credit to finance imports and exports. It becomes harder to get dollar liquidity to finance foreign investment. It becomes harder for central banks to get their hands on dollar reserves, which they need in order to intervene in financial markets. So I think this scenario in which alternative sources of global liquidity don't emerge and the dollar retains its monopoly as the only international currency is one in which 21st century globalization as we know it would be placed at risk. So I hope that this worst case scenario is avoided. I write in my book about a more positive one in which the Europeans and the Chinese get their act together and the United States keeps its act together. I think that's a happier world in which we will continue to enjoy the fruits of the globalization to which we've grown accustomed. So let me stop there. I'm happy to take questions from the audience.
This is KFKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Barry Eichen Green, professor of economics and political science at UC Berkeley. Following his talk, based on his book, Exorbitant Privilege, The Rise and Fall of the Dollar and the Future of the International Monetary System, Professor Eichen Green responded to questions from the audience.
Thank you, and thank you for coming to speak to the council today. In terms of gold standard, euro dollar, petrodollar, and U.S. dollar, how can we avoid inflation? When's it going to hit?
There seems to be a strong presumption underlying your question. Yes. So it's clear that we have seen a monetary policy in the last 4+ years, unlike anything in U.S. history, reflecting the fact that we have seen economic conditions in the last 4 years, unlike anything in U.S. history. As the Fed has expanded its balance sheet and pumped money and credit into the economy in enormous quantities, people have been warning of inflation for several years now. And significant levels of inflation above 2% have not materialized. It has not happened. Some prices have gone up by more than that. Others have gone down. Inflation remains under control. So you asked the right question toward the end there. How long before we see the inflationary response? If you double the money supply, you would expect to double the price level eventually. But how long? Not until all the excess capacity we see in the economy begins to be used up. Not until the banks, which have a large amount of liquidity but are not lending it all out, begin to lend it. And not unless the Fed fails to reverse out what it's done. So the Fed has done a lot of studies of what would be involved in reversing out its past operations before the inflation hits. It has a variety of devices, and I think one that can reassure us is that a lot of the bonds and other securities that the Fed has bought are relatively short maturity. They mature in 2, 3, 5 years. The Fed doesn't have to sell them into the market and tank the market in mortgage-backed securities by selling its mortgage-backed paper. It can just let it mature and roll off the balance sheet. So the answer to your question really depends on whether you think the Fed has the instruments and the competence to reverse out what it's done, and whether it has the political insulation to do that as well. If the Fed sees that inflation about which you're worried begin to materialize, and it begins to take action against that, if economic growth slows as a result, our monetary policymakers may hesitate. And if they do, for political reasons, that's when the problem would arise.
Dr. Eckengreen, John Wanamaker here. I'd love to hear your thoughts on Bitcoin.
On
Bitcoin.
On Bitcoin. So everyone in the room knows what Bitcoin is, of course, and can explain it to me. Bitcoin is electronic money created by apparently by some anonymous Japanese programmers, anonymous Japanese geeks, that can be used for transactions if you can find someone else in cyberspace prepared to accept it. So my thoughts on Bitcoin are that it's a long way from becoming a normal money. A normal money generally has a government standing behind it, or at least there's some transparency about how it's created. And how Bitcoins are created is a little bit opaque to us outsiders. There's a stable supply, in other words, and there's also a stable demand because people can use it for actual transactions. But Bitcoin can really only be used for speculation. People hold it because they think other people might want to hold it and it might go up in value. And that's the definition of a speculative market where value will shoot up one day and shoot down the next. Some of us were talking about this last night. I find Linden dollars more appealing. You can at least use them in on the online website Second Life to buy electronic goods and services. And I should just say, because people ask about this often as well, gold and the gold standard. My answer about gold is similar to my answer about Bitcoin, that people hold gold because they think its price may go up and other people will want to hold more of it. But again, that's the definition of a speculative market, where the intrinsic value of gold for very limited industrial purposes and ornamental purposes is not that great.
Thank you for your remarks, Professor. This presentation has been really fascinating. My question is pertaining to your reference to structural reforms among some of the more beleaguered economies of Europe. Could you define more what kinds of structural reforms might be considered for those economies, and what the, I know this is not an easy question to answer, but what's the right balance between austerity and structural reforms as a means to try and stabilize their economies?
The crisis economies of Europe have been pursuing a very ambitious program of structural reforms for the last few years with some success. They have accomplished a good deal, although not enough. What does that mean? Answer depends on the country you're talking about, of course. In countries like Greece, it means actually getting people to pay taxes. That's a useful achievement in a market economy. So what the Papandreou government, the previous government, did usefully was it used Google Earth to identify people who had swimming pools but hadn't reported them on their property tax bills, and it found many thousands of such. So they're tightening up using technology and putting in place a modern tax administration. They're doing, in a variety of countries, labor market reforms, which is very important to allow firms to ramp up and ramp down more easily. They're reducing hiring and firing costs. In European countries, firms are reluctant to hire more workers because if doing so was a mistake and they have to lay that worker back off, they have to pay severance pay for 3 years. That would make you hesitate. So they're dealing with those problems. They have the custom of Christmas money in Portugal. You get a 13th month of salary, or a 14th month even in some places, and they're addressing those practices. Public sector civil servants were paid a lot more than comparable people in the private sector. They had stronger unions. They're addressing that as well. They're doing privatization, where inefficient public enterprises need to be put on a solid footing. That's a lot of reform for societies to absorb. They need to do all those things. But I think they need some economic growth in order to make the consequences palatable. You know, if all these changes and salary reductions and so forth are occurring all at once, and the size of the pie is shrinking, that's really tough. So coming to the austerity point, I think they need less austerity now while the economy is weak and structural reform is underway, and more austerity in the future when the economy can handle it. That's, I think, what an economist would say, and then a political scientist would say, can you really believe their promise to do more austerity in the future if they do less now? And that's the difficulty of adjustment when you have weak political systems, which is what they have.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, please, a round of applause for Dr. Eichengreen. And again, thank you, all of us, for joining us today. We'll see you at our next program.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Barry Eichengreen, professor of economics and political science at UC Berkeley. He responded to audience questions following his talk based on his book, Exorbitant Privilege, The Rise and Fall of the Dollar and the Future of the International Monetary System. Professor Eichengreen was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council and recorded speaking at the Hilton Anchorage on April 19, 2013. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.